And then I want to talk about process theology. We talked about how they color code the New Testament and the Gospels, and they published their work, the Five Gospels, in 1993, which is the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four canonical Gospels, and then they added to it the Gospel of Thomas. Red in red ink, Jesus definitely said it, so there's very little red ink. Pink, Jesus probably said it, very little pink. Most of it is gray, Jesus possibly said it, but probably didn't. And black, Jesus definitely did not say it. So these guys are very far left, very radical in their thought. As we mentioned a few weeks ago, Gospel of John, no red, one pink, and only a few gray. Over 82% of Jesus' sayings in the four Gospels are rejected. Only 15 sayings of Jesus are red-lettered in all four Gospels combined. So, I mean, it's just the results of the Jesus Seminar alone are enough to call into question their work. They're probably 99% of New Testament scholars would not agree with such a radical approach, such results. Yet, you know, the problem is, though, the media is going to report these guys as these are the guys in the know, these are cutting-edge thinkers. In reality, these guys are throwbacks. New Testament scholarship has come a long way since Bultmann. Their attitude is still that we can know very little, if anything, of the historical Jesus. That's where New Testament scholarship is not there today. Supposedly, they say that Jesus never claimed to be God, Messiah, or Savior. Again, its members are a small, radical branch, a radical subset of New Testament scholarship. They do not represent the majority of New Testament scholarship, even though CNN would like us to believe that that's the case. Almost half of the 74 members, now this is when they had 74 members, now they're up to about 225 because they're inviting anybody, guys who aren't even close to New Testament scholars. But almost half of their 74 members earned their graduate degrees from either Harvard, Claremont, or Vanderbilt. They're probably the three most radically liberal biblical departments or New Testament departments in the world. European scholars are not represented, so you're not going to see N.T. Wright or Larry Hurtado. Those are the if you want to talk cutting-edge scholarship, you got to go into the European scholars. Even great American scholars like James Charlesworth, who's not an evangelical, even he would have nothing to do with these guys. He's out of Princeton, though. He's not a European scholar, but whatever the case, European scholars are not represented. As I mentioned about Charlesworth, as a side note, he's now dating John's Gospel at about the mid-50s A.D., and that's a liberal New Testament scholar. So that's where liberal New Testament scholarship, they're now beginning to, most would not date John's Gospel that early. They've got to date it before 110 A.D. because the apostolic fathers are already quoting John. A lot will try to date it to the 90s, late 1st century, maybe early 2nd century A.D., but they're now starting to acknowledge that, you know, even those who reject John as the author, they're starting to acknowledge that there's a lot of information that whoever the author of the Gospel of John is, he got information that goes back to the time of Christ, or at least that 20, 30 years within the time of Christ. I would argue that they need to go a step further. The author is obviously an eyewitness of the events and obviously brings a Jewish perspective. But it is interesting, too, the Gospel of John, the enemy is not the Romans, like you see in the book of Revelation. Well, if the enemy is the Jews, Jewish religious leaders, that seems to beg for a pre-70 AD date. But whatever the case, European scholars are not represented. Obviously, evangelical scholars are not represented. See, basically, these guys selected only quote-unquote scholars who agree with them. Okay, it would be like if we decided, you know, hey, let's just start our own group with the Institute of Biblical Defense, and you have to believe in inerrancy, and then we get together and decide, well, let's start taking votes, and then report to the news that, boy, astounding results. We believe that Jesus said everything he's quoted as saying in the Gospels. That's not news, because you knew what the results were going to be before they took votes. And it's the same here. That'd be like when we get a Republican candidate against a Democrat candidate, and you go to the Democratic convention and you take a poll from your poll and say, well, that's 100% certainty the Democratic candidate's going to win the election. You're only going to one side. And these guys are only going to one side, but it's not even like Republicans and Democrats, but at least they represent, by the way voters vote, a big chunk of the population. These guys represent a very small slice of New Testament scholarship, probably, you know, at the most 3-4%. So they really are, they're only inviting their own guys. 40 of the 74 members that were there in the mid-80s are relative unknowns. What that means is, you know, just because, you know, some of them don't even have their PhD degree in New Testament studies, but to be a New Testament scholar, normally it's going to entail that you got your PhD in New Testament studies, and that you're published in scholarly journals, or you've written scholarly books, and then that have been open to peer review and things of that sort. So these guys have not really represented, you know, really not proven their scholarship, a good portion of them. But they do have some legit. Crossan is accepted as a scholar. Marcus Borg, Burton Mack. So, you know, they have a few, Robert Funk, they have a few that are acknowledged as scholars, but they're considered kind of way out on the fringe scholarship. And I would argue that nothing that they're saying is really original, other than they're giving a little bit of a New Age twist to the secular Jesus that we're so used to hearing about from liberal scholars. When everything is said and done, point J is the most important point there. It's their bias against the supernatural. That determines where they're going. Their bias against the supernatural is so strong. Now, keep in mind, all the New Testament scholarship, even conservative New Testament scholars, they're learning from professors who first assume miracles are impossible, so the Jesus of the Bible cannot be the Jesus of history. And then they're arguing from there. But just now they're starting, the New Testament scholars are starting to scratch their heads, and they're saying, maybe he did perform miracles. So even starting with this real negative foundation, they're still ending up right where evangelicals are, where their Jesus is starting to look a lot like the Jesus of the Bible. The Jesus Seminar will not give up on this bias against miracles. Any mention of miracles in the scriptures is almost completely thrown out. Now, let me say, if you start out with a bias against miracles, but you start to acknowledge that Jesus was, in some sense of the word, a faith healer, and that's what the Jesus Seminar acknowledges, and that he was, in some sense of the word, an exorcist. Now, in their way of thinking, there's no demons, so he's like a super psychologist who really handles, you know, gets people who are insane and makes them better in one encounter. And the Jesus Seminar is acknowledging this. I mean, for guys who are biased against miracles, it's amazing how much they admit. And they say he's a faith healer, but they say he's probably psychosomatic healing. So the guy who couldn't walk all his life, you know, and that type of thing, he probably could have walked, but he just had this mental block, and Jesus removed it. The next thing you know, the guy's up and about. So even with their bias against miracles, it's amazing how much they'll admit. Having said that, the philosophical bias against miracles is a hangover from modernism. And modernism, the idea that the laws of nature prescribe the way things have to be and that miracles are impossible, very few philosophers believe that today. So in other words, these New Testament scholars are hanging on to a philosophical belief, a philosophical bias that most philosophers no longer have. Okay? Many philosophers still reject miracles, but they don't reject it before their research. They say, well, you know, we've got to look into it. These things might be possible. We can't rule them out. But I still haven't seen enough evidence to believe in miracles. They might say that. But this bias against the supernatural is a bias. It doesn't come from studying the New Testament. It doesn't come from their scholarship. They bring this into their studies. Okay? They assume that everything in the Gospels is false until proven true. When Aristotle's dictum was that when you read a purported historical work, you consider it true unless you find evidence proving otherwise. We know Josephus contains inaccuracies. Overall, it's pretty accurate, but there's some inaccuracies we found in Josephus. But there might be a passage mentioned in the New Testament or the Old Testament that liberal scholars will reject until they find out that, oh, wait a minute, Josephus reported it too, so now we can accept it. So it's like, it ought to be the other way around. The Old and New Testaments have proven themselves to be so historically reliable that we ought to put a big question mark with Josephus until proven by the Bible, if we're going to put a question mark by anybody. But the normal way of doing research, Josephus, the Bible, Homer's Iliad, it doesn't matter. The normal way is assume everything to be true until you find evidence to the contrary. Now, of course, with Homer's Iliad, there's a lot of evidence to the contrary because it's written as mythology. So it's written like it's not exactly recording fact. They believe in a non-supernatural original manuscript with Jesus' sayings, which no one has ever seen, called Q. What they do is they take the, you know, they assume that Matthew, Mark, and Luke have so much in common that they copied off each other, that Mark was written first, and Luke and Matthew copied off of Mark because they don't want, you know, an original apostle like Matthew to be an author. And then they say they contradict each other. Look, if they contradict each other, they didn't copy each other. You know, what are these guys, ignoramuses? We're not dealing with difficult numbers. Can't you get it right? Was there two angels at the tomb, or was there one angel at the tomb? If that's really a contradiction, which is not, because the Gospels that say there's only one angel at the tomb, all they're focused on is the one angel who's speaking. They don't say one angel only. They say there was one angel at the tomb. We could say there's two guys at the study. Tomorrow I could say there were two guys at the study, at last night's study, that I want to talk about. Well, then somebody comes back and says, there's six guys. Somebody comes back and says, no, there weren't two guys, there were six guys. I can say, yeah, but that's okay. I only wanted to talk about two. You know, Robert and Andrew, the two exciting guys. Why are you three guys laughing? Did they copy off each other? If they copied off each other, then why would you call these contradictions? If they're contradictions, then they didn't copy off each other. Whatever the case, I think we could come up with solutions, like Leeson Archer's Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulties, where you could see that there was really no contradiction there. These guys are really arguing in a circle. Now, let me say this. Most of New Testament scholars today, even conservative New Testament scholars, believe in Q. And that shouldn't be the case. But where do conservative scholars get their training from? From liberal professors, okay? What they found is that how could they say Matthew and Luke were copying from Mark when both Matthew and Luke have some sayings that are almost identical, you know, the same sayings, maybe worded a little differently in a few places, and these sayings that they have in common, some of them aren't even in Mark. And so they say, okay, well then that means that Matthew and Luke must have also copied from another written document which Mark didn't have access to. So they would date Q back to about the 40s A.D., and some of the sayings of Jesus. Now, you can buy Q, even though it never really existed. If it did exist, it was just some of the notes, probably some of the notes of Matthew. Matthew, as a tax collector, probably was the stenographer for the apostles, probably took notes. You know, Matthew probably had those lecture notes, plus his other lecture notes, from other things that even Mark had access to through Peter, because we know everybody agrees Mark got his gospel from Peter. Papias comes right out and tells us, okay? Of course, Papias tells us that Matthew wrote Matthew, and liberal scholars don't have a problem just ignoring that. But whatever the case, if Q really existed, it was just some of Matthew's notes that might have been circulated. Each of the apostles might have had copies of it. I'm even open to the possibility that Matthew may have had notes. And the part-time stenographer might have been a young guy who might have shown some writing skills at an early age. Might have been the Apostle John, that it seems either he had a really good memory or the Holy Spirit just brought it to his remembrance, or John actually took notes when he was alone. A few times when Jesus is alone, he might not really be alone. It might be, well, you know, send the adult apostles out on to get food or whatever, and Jesus will talk to the Samaritan woman. But, you know, well, yeah, teenager John was with me. You know, so it may have been, John may have been with him for, you know, when Jesus met with Nicodemus, when he met with a Samaritan woman. Different occasions where somebody's got to give the report and Matthew's not around. Well, sometimes just James, John, and Peter were at Jesus. So the notes might have been taken by John, or maybe as soon as he got back, he wrote what he remembered. But whatever the case, it seems that some of the sermons that you find in the Gospel of John were a little bit too radical, to circulate in Jerusalem. And if Matthew's Gospel is written first, which is what the early church fathers all thought, so that's what I think, if Matthew's Gospel is written first and was written by an eyewitness, one of the apostles, he may have decided, you know, when I put together my Gospel, I'm going to leave out some of these sermons about Jesus telling us we've got to eat his flesh and drink his blood. These kinds, you know, most of the Jews are going to find that a little bit too crazy. And some of Jesus' statements, I and the Father are one. Before Abraham was born, I am. We're trying to lead Jews to Jesus, not push him away. Let's keep his more explicit claims to be God, keep them out, and give his more mild claims to be God and report that. And so Matthew, Mark, and Luke seem to have access to, quite possibly, Matthew's sermon notes. You know, Peter would have probably taken a copy of the notes. And the material that they selected could have been an abridged version of Jesus' teachings, whereas by the time John's writing, and in the area that he's writing, in what is now modern Turkey, around Ephesus and all, John probably thought, hey, we need to make this clear. We have Jesus, and the Gospel's written before mine, assuming John had access to them. He's claiming to be God very clearly, but to the Jewish mindset. Let me give those explicit claims to be God that the other guys left out, because the Gentiles need to know who Jesus is really claiming to be. This Q, I don't know if it existed, but if it did exist, it was probably sermon notes from Matthew, which were probably taken as Jesus was speaking. If I were God and I became a man, and I had 12 apostles, I would want somebody to take notes. Q existed. It's actually much more powerful than they make it out to be. Now, having said that, you can buy a copy of Q at Barnes & Noble. You can build a strong case that Jesus is claiming to be God in Q, that he performed miracles, that he cast out demons, that he believed he was ushering the kingdom of God, and that your eternal destiny rested on him, all from Q alone. And most New Testament scholars will say, yeah, I believe in Q. I think it dates back to the 40s A.D. It predates even Paul's writings. Okay? So they can no longer blame Paul for turning Jesus into a god. Now, Jesus Seminar, what do they do with Q? They layer Q. They have the earlier Q, the wisdom literature, like philosophical type things, in the 40s A.D., which Jesus probably didn't say most of them anyway. And then in the 50s A.D., maybe some other literature, and then the real bold claims to the 60s A.D. They're the only guys with the audacity to layer Q. Okay? Anybody else is saying, yeah, Q goes to the 40s A.D. I think John Wyndham's work out of Great Britain, redating the Gospels, where he dates Matthew's Gospel back to the early 40s A.D., Mark to the mid-40s, Luke, 40s or 50s. I think he's a lot closer to it. There's a few Catholic scholars that are dating Matthew's Gospel to the 30s A.D. now, Mark to the 40s. Luke, it's a tough one to call. I've been dating Luke to the mid-50s A.D., but now I'm starting to see Paul was either quoting, not so much quoting, but alluding to Luke's Gospel when he wrote Galatians around 49 A.D., or he was alluding to the notes that went into Luke's gospel. So he may have commissioned Luke to write that gospel. He may have given some of the information to him because he got some of the information from Jesus himself. Luke had plenty of time to interview the apostles just when Paul's visits to Jerusalem. But whatever the case, John A. T. Robinson, he was a very liberal scholar. He was, you know, wrote his work Honest to God, where he was actually, his thoughts were part of the Death of God movement in the 1960s, where it was almost like a Christian atheism. He was so liberal in his thought. But then as he got older and he started doing some research, he wrote Redating the New Testament, where his dating was more radical than even my own or New Testament scholars, conservative New Testament scholars today, where he dated every new book of the New Testament before 70 A.D. In fact, he dates some of the Apostolic Fathers' writings back to the 70s. He's even open to the possibility that the Epistle of Barnabas may have been written in 70 A.D., but he dates quite a bit of the Apostolic Fathers' writings to the 70s to 90s A.D. Everybody knows Ignatius was written 107 A.D. Polycarp wrote his work 110 A.D. Papias probably writing about, at the latest, 130 A.D. But the Shepherd of Hermas, Epistle of Barnabas, Clement of Rome, we lock him in at 95 A.D., but I think John A.T. Robinson argues for an earlier date there. You know, whatever the case, this is highly speculative reasoning, and these guys don't even with this highly speculative reasoning, most New Testament scholarship is moving closer and closer to evangelicals. Okay? If we had 100 New Testament scholars in here from all different schools of thought, probably 80 to 85 of them for the first 2 or 3 hours of discussion would sound like evangelicals. It would take a long time before we would hear things and start to think, wait a minute, that guy's not an evangelical. He doesn't believe the Bible is God's word. Because so much of what they accept about the historical Jesus is in agreement with what we teach. See, what they've done is they've placed Jesus, now they're doing it with Paul, by the way, and they've said, look, we tried to come up with a Jesus who was real Greek in his thinking, and it made no sense. We found no Jesus at all. Let's put Jesus back in his historical context, okay? Well, by doing that, putting Jesus in his Jewish culture, all of a sudden, even passages that they know Jesus said, that most New Testament scholars say he said, are clear claims to be God. Just by calling himself Savior, he's claiming to be God. And Bridegroom, he's claiming to be God, because Yahweh is the Bridegroom. Yahweh is the Savior in the Old Testament. Let me just give you a couple of the principles that they use. Now, let me say, most liberal scholars use these principles. However, even from using them, they found out, wow, so much about the historical Jesus is true. One is the principle of dissimilarity. Okay? The principle of dissimilarity. What that means is that anything that Jesus says or does that is consistent with first century Judaism, he didn't really say. Because he butt heads with first century Judaism. Okay, that's why he died. So they throw that out. Then they say, anything that Jesus says that the early church taught, he didn't say, that's the early church putting those words into his mouth. So the problem with the principle of dissimilarity is, we're supposed to believe that Jesus was a Jewish boy growing up in the first century AD who was not influenced one iota by his Jewish culture. I mean, a Jewish boy, you call a Jewish boy Jewish because he's Jewish. He's in the Jewish culture. He's influenced by the Jewish culture. Secondly, he starts a church and he's not supposed to have any influence on that church at all. You would expect the founder of a church to have great impact on him. Okay? If that's the kind of Jesus you're looking for, that makes him different from everybody who ever lived. Because everybody's influenced by their culture, and they influence the people they influence. Jesus supposedly wasn't influenced at all by his culture, and then didn't influence the people he influenced. That's baloney. Anyway, using this principle of this similarity, still, scholars came up with, well, wait a minute. only one time in the New Testament is Jesus called the Son of Man outside the Gospels. The other 80 times it's in the Gospels, and it's either Jesus calling himself that or somebody else talking to Jesus and using that phrase, but it's primarily Jesus, a title that Jesus gave to himself. So most New Testament scholars today say that you have to accept the Son of Man statements of Jesus, because the early church couldn't put that in its mouth, because the early church did not call Jesus the Son of Man. Just read Stephen's statement, his last sermon, or when he's about to die, he saw the Son of Man standing at the Father's right hand. Except for that, the New Testament doesn't even contain it. You don't even find it in the Apostolic Fathers. I mean, it's just Son of Man statements are gone. So that had to come from Jesus. Even liberal scholars agree, except for the Jesus Seminar. So the problem is, you look at all the Son of Man statements, and Jesus is this miracle-working guy who thought of himself as the Jewish Messiah. He was ushering in God's kingdom, claimed your eternal destiny rested on him, and he spoke of himself as if he was God. So that's the problem that liberal New Testament scholarship has. They're trying to face that, come to grips with that. Okay? A lot of them, what they're doing is they're saying that Jesus functionally, he functioned as a deity. In other words, what they're saying is, yes, he accepted worship, and the early Christians worshipped him, and he spoke as if he were God, but he didn't literally mean he was God. He just meant, I'm standing in the role of God. That's baloney. The New Testament scholars, they will say that, and then you try to question them on it, and they just want to drop the subject, because Jewish monotheism, you don't worship any of the prophets. And if there's a prophet greater than Moses, the greatest prophet, that prophet's God in the flesh. And that's exactly what Jesus was claiming to be. So there's no prophets, super prophets, and then God. There's just prophets or God. Jesus wasn't claiming to be prophets. He's claiming to be greater than the prophets. Another principle that they use, besides dissimilarity, multiple attestation. What they're saying is, if something is mentioned by more than one source, it's probably true. Now keep in mind, the Jesus Seminar, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are not considered separate sources. They just morph them together. But now they're starting to find evidence. Even real liberal scholars are starting to find evidence. They realize that a lot of what John taught came from real early. So they're seeing John as a separate source than the synoptics, ancient creeds. And so through multiple attestation, we're starting to find an awful lot of evidence. Even with liberal assumptions, we're moving in the direction of the Jesus of the Bible. Another would be called enemy attestation, or at least, in other words, either if your enemies are saying something about you, then and you're saying it about yourself, then it's probably true. If it wasn't true, you'd say it about yourself, but your enemies would reject it. But kind of what flows out of that too is that if Jesus is quoted as saying something that could obviously be used as evidence against him, then the apostles probably didn't make that up, because they're trying to build a new religious movement. They're not trying to kill a religious movement. Okay? So if Jesus says, look, only the Father knows the day or the hour of my return. The angels in heaven don't know it. Even the Son doesn't know it. He's referring to himself. Only my Father who's in heaven. Well, Jehovah's Witnesses love to use that passage. See, Jesus isn't God because he doesn't know everything. They have no knowledge of the kenosis, the divine humiliation, Jesus choosing to not tap into some of his divine powers while he was on earth. So they're just bad theologians. They have no knowledge of the hypostatic union, that Jesus is one person with two natures forever. They butcher that passage. However, that passage has been used in ancient times and in modern times throughout the history of the church as evidence against Jesus being God. So why in the world would the apostles say, look, it's like the apostles saying, look, we're trying to convince people that Jesus is God. Let's quote Jesus as saying that only the Father knows the day or hour of my return. I don't know. As the son, I don't know. They wouldn't make it up. So this particular principle, since it can be used by the enemies of the apostles, by their opponents against them, they did not make this up. Jesus really said it. But there's a problem there. Liberal scholars, by their own biased principles, have to admit that Jesus said that. And Jesus' seminar probably just does their own dance and just they violate their own principles. Most New Testament scholars say, yeah, Jesus said that. And then you say, well, there, you realize the problem there, don't you? The New Testament scholars say, yes. And then if they're real liberal scholars, they say, yes, and I don't know what to say about it. So what is the problem? Well, the problem is, if Jesus said, the Father knows the day or the hour of my return, but not the Son, the problem is that even most liberal scholars today acknowledge Jesus considered himself the Son of God. They also acknowledge that first century Judaism, if you considered yourself the Son of God in a unique way that nobody else was the Son of God, you were considering yourself equal with God. So, and in other words, liberal scholars have thrown out explicit Christology where Jesus unambiguously claims to be God, where he clearly claims to be God. But now what they're finding is even in the other passages, implicit Christology where Jesus, through his actions or his words, implies things about himself, we have the same picture of God as you have with all those explicit claims to be God here. See, when you're saying, well, this couldn't be true because this entails miracles, only this stuff could be true, and even there we'll have to find evidence for it. Then you find evidence for it. Once you find this is true, then you start finding out what it means. It means to say the same thing as this, which means you had no reason to throw this out in the first place. So, if anything, from the study of the Synoptic Gospels, it should cause us to embrace the Gospel of John. There are New Testament scholars who are not conservatives who are now taking a second look at the Gospel of John. James Charlesworth, the reason why he dates it to the mid-50s A.D., is because some of the handwriting and the style of writing is almost identical to some of the later manuscripts found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the latest, they could be dated to 68 A.D., because that's when the Romans lambasted the area. And then the Gospel of Thomas, anybody who puts the Gospel of Thomas on the same level as the four canonical Gospels, I think is really think we need to start calling into question the character of these people who are doing this. Bart Ehrman, you know, loves the Gospel of Judas, loves the Gospel of Thomas. Now, but by the way, scholars who put the Gospel of Thomas on the same level as the other Gospels, they don't really believe Thomas wrote that. They believe it was written by a guy who was lying through his teeth. He wasn't really Thomas. And they know that they were written by Gnostics who could give a hoot about the historical Jesus. They could care less about the historical Jesus. But see, that's what these liberal scholars are trying to claim about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as well. And you just can't get there. It's right off the bat, it starts out that these are the secret sayings of Jesus to the Apostle Thomas. It's a Gnostic document, heretical writing. 140 A.D. is the earliest that can be dated. Even the most liberal of scholars will date Mark's Gospel between 69 and 67 A.D. But I think that you can date Mark actually back 20 years earlier, Matthew earlier than that, and Luke right around that time. Whatever the case, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Judas, there's no reason. I mean, I'm not a New Testament scholar, but to be totally honest with you, I'd be willing to debate anybody from the Jesus Seminar or Bart Ehrman. These guys are experts on the language and languages and everything. But the fact of the matter is, a highly suspect thesis is still a highly suspect thesis. Elaine Pagel's another example, religion professor from Princeton. She's in love with the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Judas and the Gospel of Mary and the Gospel of Philip, and these are all clearly Gnostic, bogus writings. The National Geographic reported that the Gospel of Judas was incredibly early. What they meant by that was that it could be dated to about 160 A.D. Well, that's not news, guys, because the only reason why you guys were looking for the Gospel of Judas was because Irenaeus, the early church father in 180 AD, was arguing that it was a heretical Gnostic work and that it wasn't really written by Judas, obviously. But 160 AD is incredibly early, according to National Geographic, when they're talking about the Gospel of Judas, because it doesn't have a Christian message. It contradicts the Christian message. But 67 AD from Mark's Gospel, which I think is too late of a date, but 67 AD is not incredibly early. When they talk about Mark's Gospel, they say, well, it was written so much later. Almost 40 years after Jesus walked the earth. You can't trust that as being reliable. And he said, well, look here, the Gospel of Judas. This is written like 130 years after Jesus. That's early. I mean, so early is early. You know, early, for all private purpose, sometimes when they use the word early, it seems to me that they're saying it's good. Here's an anti-Christian document. And then when they use the word late, it's like, well, this is a Christian document, so we're going to dismiss it, even though it's so close to the time that Jesus lived. Whatever the case, there's tremendous evidence for the reliability of the four Gospels, as well as the rest of the New Testament. In fact, 25, you got the manuscript evidence, there's more copies of the New Testament, over 26,000 handwritten copies that we have before the invention of the printing press. 5,000 were written in the original language, the Greek. You have a few thousand written in the Old Latin, which goes just almost as far back. The Old Syriac as well. You have, you know, second place of all of ancient literature is Homer's Iliad, with only 643 copies. Plato's writings, you only have 7 copies, and nobody questions what was written. Plato's writings, 7 copies, but those copies date about 1,200 years after the original was supposedly written. They said, well, that's not a problem, though. We get that. We have that problem with most of ancient literature. So we can accept Plato's writings as reliable. Okay, well, then what's the problem with the New Testament when you have not 7 copies, or 1,200 years removed, but instead you have 26,000 copies, and the earliest of these copies go either from 0 to 25 years from when the originals were written? John Ryland's fragment of John chapter 18 is usually dated about 135 AD, but John Ryland said, no, it's between 100 and 135 AD. And then he said, but it's probably more than likely around 100 AD. Papyrologists and experts on ancient fragments are now arguing it's closer to 100 AD. There's some papyrologists who are arguing that the Chester Beatty papyri, which contains large portions of the Gospel of John and most large portions of the New Testament, that should be dated to the 90s AD. If we think the New Testament was completed around 95 AD, and we have copies that go right back to that time, I mean, we might be looking in some instances at copies of the originals themselves. The Apostolic Fathers, just 3 of the Apostolic Fathers. The Apostolic Fathers were pupils of the Apostles, selected by the Apostles to lead the early church. So these were not their D students. Okay? These were their A-plus students. And they appointed them to be elders in the churches. And eventually when the Apostles died, they said, well, this elder over here was John's number one student. Let's make him the bishop. And the people would vote the guy in as the bishop and all. We just take 3 of them. Ignatius, who was writing 107 AD when he was about to be thrown to the wild beast for his faith. Clement of Rome, who wrote in 95 AD. And Polycarp, who wrote in 110 AD. Those 3, you combine them, and they quote from or allude to 25 out of the 27 of the New Testament books. We have 27 New Testament books. They quote from 25 of them. I believe the only ones not mentioned by them are 2 Peter and 2 John, if I remember correctly. The fact of the matter is, they're small books. You know, I wouldn't expect them to quote from every one. So it's not even an argument against them. But what I'm saying is, by 95 to 110 AD, the church knew, for all practical purposes, what the New Testament authoritative books were. Now, I doubt they drew up a list and said, these and these alone are the only ones, but they knew the ones. The only time they had to really start saying, hey, we better come up with a list, was when guys like Marcion were removing books And then when other heretics were added, the Gnostics were adding phony books. Then eventually the church, by the close of the 2nd century A.D., late 180s, 190s A.D., by then you see early church fathers trying to come up with a list. Now the problem is, though, at that point, some of these guys might not have had access to one or two books, so you might have one or two books called into question. Hebrews, by 170, 180, 190 A.D., is being called into question by some. I can't remember if it was Irenaeus or Tertullian, between 180 and 220 A.D., not only believed Hebrews belonged to the Bible, but they were arguing that Barnabas was the author. Some people are going to lose track by that amount of time, and if they don't know who the author of Hebrews is, they might question its authorship. Okay? I might question whether it should be in the canon. So you had a few debates. I would argue the debates came in the late 2nd century, and that they wouldn't have been there in the 1st century, but in the late 1st century AD, you didn't need to come up with a list. You knew that there were certain writings of Paul that were being read in all the churches that could get their hands on it. And so those were the authoritative books. Okay? As much authority as the Gospels and as much authority as the Old Testament. But there wasn't really a big need to come up with a list of the books, because there weren't people writing bogus books, nor were there people trying to deny these.